Blog Talk Radio.
Talk about termination era policies of boarding schools and the Indian Adoption Act and all those things that took our children, in some cases forcibly, put them in non-native homes, subjected them to environments of abuse. It's really something that needs to be talked about with a good, honest conversation, but we need to do that in the spirit of not blaming, but this is what happened. How do we move forward to assure that these things never happen again?
For the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's meant to help Maine and Wabanaki governments move forward together.
You know, there were some when I started working on this process that said, why would you need that process? We have the Indian Child Welfare Act. We have good policy. And as I said in my remarks earlier, that's not enough.
I'm thinking a lot about my older sisters, and I have some sadness that they haven't had the opportunity to go through this process that I have and been able to do some healing around what happened. I can hold my children, even though they're adults, and I can hold them and I can tell them that I love them and truly, truly feel love for them. And I wasn't able to do that before. We're going to work with our communities and we're all going to start the conversation about what happened. People will come forward and tell their stories to the Truth Commission. Families of these individuals will come forward also to tell their stories. The children who were affected by those of us in foster care. We will not only heal as families and be able to change and deconstruct the trauma, but I think we can heal as communities.
I said earlier, my best hope for this is that it has widespread impact. I hope that there is healing for those that have been harmed in the past. That's important to us. For the staff that I oversee, my hope is that there is widespread understanding of what the history was, what the truth of the history was, so that they never repeat even a bit of it. That's my best hope.
Ideally, with this Truth and Reconciliation Commission focusing on Indian child welfare, I think what my ultimate goal is to have a full understanding in this state of what happens when a child from our tribe or from any of the tribal nations in Maine are displaced, what that process looks like, how they're supposed to be dealt with, and their cultural ties and their tribal affiliation is always the most important thing on that agenda. My hope is that this can become the model in all areas for how to sit down and truly try to understand the tribal perspective, as well as us understanding where the state's coming from.
Hello?
Talks and Fire Talk production. My name is Nell Cole, and I'm the host. And today we're going to have a very interesting guest. I look forward to hearing her. Esther, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Fire Talk. Can you tell us a little about yourself?
My name is Esther Atien. I am a Passamaquoddy tribal citizen from Zibayik, which is the easternmost community in the United States, easternmost Native community, located down East Maine. I live on Indian Island, which is the Penobscot community, which is located inland on the Penobscot River. I've been a guest in this community for about 30 years, and I live here with my children. I have a master's degree in social work from the University of Maine, and I work for the Muskie School of Public Service through the University of Southern Maine. I've been with them for about 9 years, and I currently am one of the lead staff people for an initiative, a groundbreaking initiative, called the Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
Can you tell us more about what that commission does?
Yes. This commission is the first official truth commission in the United States territory that deals with Native child welfare issues. And it is also the first truth commission process that we are aware of in the entire world that has been developed between a state and tribal nations. Typically, when truth commissions, if folks are familiar with truth commissions, probably the most famous one was in South Africa around apartheid and what happened to the folks in South Africa. And it was true with that commission and a lot of other commissions around the world that they're usually sanctioned by the government. The president of a country will often have a declaration or a proclamation that there will be a truth commission, and oftentimes the purpose is for nation building after some horrific acts of genocide in a country. This truth commission is a lot different. It has been developed from day one collaboratively between folks on, for lack of a better word, both sides of the issue.
Right.
So it's very unique. A lot of the work that we've done between the tribes and the state here in the state of Maine around Indian child welfare have been very groundbreaking, and we have a different approach than most of the other states that we have heard of. And a lot of our work has been possible because Maine is, I mean, geographically, we're a really large state, but population-wise, we're a real small state. And so there's a lot of intersection and networking of folks. So for instance, some of the social workers that were involved in this effort from the tribal side and the state side, you know, many of us went to the same school of social work. So there's a lot of relationships that exist there already.
I definitely want to get more into it, but I see our other guest is here as well, so let me bring her into the conversation.
Oh great, great.
Misty, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Are you
I'm on the road traveling to Aberdeen.
Oh, okay. First guest has already introduced herself, Song. Can you introduce yourself as well?
Yeah. My name's Misty Sue Little. I'm from the Oglala Sioux Tribe. Both my parents were activists. My dad was an AIM activist. My mom, she mostly stayed home and took care of us. Anyway, today I'm on the show because I feel that it's wrong about what the state is doing to our kids, how they're using them to make money and use them, and how they're covering up people, abusing them in these white foster homes they're putting them in. And I'm with Madonna Thunderhawk and my cousin Aloha Martinez.
Oh, and, I didn't realize who you were going to be with. We're actually going to speak about some of her work today because she's put out some really good work on the is it LakotaLaw.org? Yes, some of the information I've been posting that she's been speaking about on her webpage is pretty staggering in what's happening to the youth in your community.
And she's here, too, if you'd like to talk to her, too.
Definitely, as we get deeper in, if she's interested, I'd love to speak to her as well and tie it all together.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Right now I want to go back to Esther and hear more about what's going on in her community, and then I'll come back to you, okay?
Okay.
All right. Esther, you still there?
I am.
All right.
I'd like to talk about
Esther, can you tell us more about what happened in your community to create this Truth and Reconciliation Committee?
Sure. Actually, the history of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission process here in Maine started back in the late 90s. In the state of Maine in 1999, the state, I'll back up, all states in the country receive funding for their child welfare programs from the federal government. And that's administered through the Administration for Children and Families, ACF. And ACF evaluates states on how they are running their child welfare programs. They evaluate them on many points, and one of them is their compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Act. And in 1999, the state of Maine had their program performance review, and they received less than exemplary scores on how they complied with the Indian Child Welfare Act, ICWA. So they were, in effect, in danger of losing some funding because of these scores. So they reached out to the tribes in Maine. In Maine, there are four Wabanaki tribes in five locations. There's the Maliseet, the Mi'kmaq, the Passamaquoddy tribe, which has two locations, and the Penobscot Nation. So in 1999, the state reached out to the tribal child welfare workers in each of those communities to ask for our help. At the time, I was working for Penobscot Nation, to ask for our help in developing a training to help their workers understand ICWA and comply with the law. So in November of 99, we all got around the table with state folks, and it was a real critical meeting, because it was actually not only the first time that the state and the tribes had sat together, but it was the first time that the tribes had sat together. We didn't have any communication with each other. We hadn't been working collaboratively with each other. We were just all doing our own thing.
Right.
So we came together, and it was a very, very tense meeting. There was a lot of mistrust. What we know in many of our communities and many of our states is, the dominant narrative is that we can't work together. We have that message. We've been socialized to believe that we cannot work together. So it was a first, and it was difficult, to say the least, but everyone around that table was very committed to making things better for Wabanaki children and families. And we stayed with it. We stayed with the task, and we started to talk about things. We started to wonder, why aren't caseworkers following ICWA? They know the law. They've been trained. They receive a copy of the law. These are trained social workers that are all in this profession to do good. So we started thinking, instead of just giving them the requirements of ICWA and telling them this is what you're mandated to do, we thought we would appeal to their sense of humanity. And we thought we would try to get them to understand why the Indian Child Welfare Act was necessary. So we started, we devised a day-long training, and in the morning of the whole morning of the training was focused on Wabanaki history. We talked about boarding schools. We talked about policies of genocide and strategies of forced assimilation that made legislation like the Indian Child Welfare Act necessary. We talked about the fact that in 1999, 16% of all Maliseet children under the age of 18 were in state care. And we produced a video. We interviewed about a dozen Wabanaki people who had been in state care prior to 1978. And they shared their stories about what happened to them, about how it has affected them as a parent, how it has affected their family and their community. And we gleaned a lot of information from that video. Two things emerged. What we found out was, regardless of their experience that they had in foster care or adoption, because we had, you know, varied experiences. We had folks who were tortured and sexually abused and physically abused in these foster homes. And then we had folks who were in the most loving, welcoming homes that helped them keep connection to their tribe and that were really models of, you know, how ICWA is supposed to work. But regardless of their experience in care, two things emerged. One, they still had that trauma. The trauma was in the taken. The trauma was in being taken from their community. And the other thing that emerged was that how that trauma manifests itself was in their parenting. All of these people were parents, and all of them had a very difficult time. In the beginning of the show, you played the trailer that's on our website, and you heard Denise Altivator speak about how now that she's gone through sharing her story and talking about what happened and dealt with it, she is finally able to love her children in a way that she could never do before,
right,
because of the disconnect that trauma in the taken had caused. So we developed this training in 99, and at the same time, as I mentioned, 16% of all Maliseet children were in care, and the chief of the Maliseet Nation, Brenda Commander, on one evening, the sheriff's department showed up and a caseworker showed up to take another child into care, and her and some other grandmothers went down there, and she said no, and she physically stopped them. She said, "You are not taking any more of our children." And that action she took really spurred a lot of momentum and a lot of change. She ended up working with the state, and they crafted and passed a historic agreement between the Maliseet tribe and the state of Maine, which gave Maliseets maximum participation in their child welfare cases. What's interesting to note is that within Maine, the Passamaquoddies and Penobscots have our own tribal courts, so we can assume jurisdiction over cases of our children in our territory. The Maliseets and the Mi'kmaqs don't have a tribal court, so the state has exclusive jurisdiction over all of their child welfare cases. So this was a very, very important, critical tribal-state agreement that was actually extended to all the tribes. So the tenets of that agreement of maximum participation were extended to all the tribes. So this,
now you're
this
saying
action,
60% is
16,
were in care or still are in care?
Were at the time. There has been a lot of improvements now. The numbers of Maliseet children in state care are a lot lower now since we have been able to impact training caseworkers in the pre-service training before they get, you know, once they are newly hired,
right,
and then while they are caseworkers. This group that formed to develop this training, we were called the ICWA Training Work Group, and it's still tribal and state folks working together. We have been together since 1999, and not only did we develop this training that we gave to caseworkers, but we also developed Indian Child Welfare policy that gives tribal caseworkers, tribal ICWA workers, are viewed as co-case managers of a case.
Okay, that's
so they're
a big difference.
They're given equal footing from the time of assessment all the way through the life of the case. You know, NICWA talks about the tribe being the third parent in an ICWA case, and that is really upheld, and that's what they strive for best practice. Another thing that the ICWA Training Work Group did, on two occasions, we developed a performance review for state cases, and what we did was we worked together and we created this tool, and then we pulled all of the ICWA cases that the state had at the time, and we reviewed those cases one by one, looking for you know, things that are within compliance of ICWA. Was the tribe notified? Was jeopardy found? What were the placement decisions that were made?
Right.
Was the tribe involved in the family team meeting? But we also looked for evidence of white privilege in case notes. and evidence of bias or prejudice.
Right.
So that was pretty, we did that on two occasions. So we got a lot of real good data from that, and we, instead of just, you know, approaching it and thinking, you know, we don't know where to start, we had this data to show us, you know, caseworkers are doing a good job on
right.
these things, but they need more help on these things. And that has really helped the state to tailor their work and how they supervise caseworkers so that these things can be improved. Now, this IFTA work group,
yeah.
Oh, you have a question?
Yeah, do you know what the percentage is now? Has anybody analyzed it?
Of Maliseet Children in Care? If I was in my office, I could probably get it for you, but I'm not there because it's a Sunday. So, but I know that the numbers have drastically been reduced. There is a very low percentage of children that are in state care now. Because what we know traditionally with, you know, Black children, Latino children, and Native children especially, is that there's disproportionate numbers of them in care, and that when they're in care, they stay there longer, and they have disparate outcomes. Many of them leave care without a permanent family connection,
right.
whether it's adoption or reunification. so those things that we already know, and those things that we try to work on and
right.
have an impact on.
So it
we,
sounds like where your starting point was is where our other guests are now. They're at a 60% of Native children in non-foster care who age out of the system are homeless, in prison, or dead by the age of 20. So that's where she is now. So I want to pull her in for a second and get her perspective on where they are so we can compare the two. Misty, are you there?
No, she's not here. This is Madonna Thunderhawk.
Thank you so much for coming on. I just read that the 60% of Native children in foster care. I've been looking at your website. Can you tell people more about it?
Well, right now I'm driving, but okay, I'm not up on the statistics and all that, but yeah, it's still pretty high. But what I do is I'm like a grassroots effort, the same way as like Misty. And, you know, what we're doing is mainly getting our tribal councils aware. I'm just impressed with the work that's going on and that has been going on with Maine. But in South Dakota, it's still frontier mentality out here. The state of South Dakota refuses on all levels to work with tribes unless they're in control. And right now they're in control of the money. So that's
right.
what we're, you know, we're up against, you know. And the state of South Dakota, prior to the mid-90s, they could care less about Native American children. It was the Indian problem, you know, and it was the Bureau of Indian Affairs had a handle on it. But now the money's all being funneled. During the Bush years, the money got all funneled into the state control. So that's basically where we're at. And we're fighting, you know, when you're fighting against multi-millions of dollars, what the hell, you know? It takes you know, the grassroots people to try to wake up the tribal councils to fight back. That's where
right.
we're at.
Now, they make money off of if your children are placed in adoption as opposed to being returned. The state makes a lot of money off of that. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As soon as any Native child gets in the system, they're designated as special needs, so then they get more money for them. So it's a racket.
Yeah.
It's a racket.
That special needs is a racket that they pulled in many different groups of children, normally with orphans or anyone in state care.
Oh, yeah.
They're always
looking
to increase their funding. So any kind of extra stuff, they try to tag perfectly healthy children with special needs.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't matter.
Why would they
if they're
be considered
needed.
Special needs?
Yeah, yeah.
What is it?
Okay.
Special needs is based on what reason?
They don't have to have a reason. They make them up. I mean, there's no oversight for this. There's no oversight anywhere for what the state's doing. So they can just whatever, you know. It's that serious. I mean, it's that blatant.
Now, the only reason it seems like the ones in Maine came to the table is because they were receiving a low rating that would affect their funding. Is there different ratings within your state that would affect their funding that could perhaps get them to the table?
Oh, it's me again. Sorry, she's dropping. No, we're taking them to court anyway, the state, and we're hoping that people start standing up. They have to stand up for the kids. They can't expect them to fight themselves, you know. We as parents, as mothers, as a nation, we have to start taking up for our kids and standing up for them. We can't expect them to go in there and, like, when they get taken away, to stand up and start saying stuff, because they're just kids. They need us as parents, as mothers,
right,
as grandparents, to be there for them. And the state does get a lot of money from them. That's their biggest racketeer. That's the whole thing in the state of South Dakota. All Indian kids are in need, all of them. It doesn't matter. They don't even have no problems, but they'll make up some kind of problems for them just so they could get some more money.
Now, what's the average income on, say, Pine Ridge? Is very low per year, correct?
Yes, it's probably like less than $500 a month.
So how is someone with that kind of income level supposed to fight somebody that's receiving $79,000 a year to put your child in adoption?
They can't fight. That's why the state is in control. But there's some of us that I don't make a lot of money. I sell beadwork. That's what I live off of. But I'm willing to fight for the kids, and it doesn't matter how much money I have. It's just what's in the heart, I think. And my heart's tired of seeing these poor little kids suffer, and I'm ready to stand up for them, and that's why we're on our way to Aberdeen, because of the two caseworkers. The state is trying to put them in jail for standing up and telling the people about the girl that got raped by a non-native foster parent who's a rapist. And so we're going up there to stand up for them, because we need more people like that. If they're going to work with our kids, we need more people like that standing up for them. And they're non-native.
And I'll be watching that trial and bringing different results to the air about it, because it's important when people stand up to be there to support them. Because when the system turns on them, it can be very ugly. You know, just like whistleblowers or anything else. And if you have a system in place to make that much money off of children, then, you know. And it was saying that, where I read in her article, where she was talking about over 60% of Native children in non-Native foster cares who age out of the system end up in prison or dead by 20. Is that something that you've seen within your community?
Yes, I've seen a lot of our young people going to prison. And it was probably because it's probably because their parents weren't there. Maybe they were getting raised by their grandparents. But that's whenever, like, we as a nation need to start standing up for them. We need to let them know that we're here for them. We might not be their relatives, but we can.
Well, what is this within your community to help them, the ones that are taken away? Is there anything that helps them find the way back home or helps prevent them from being taken to begin with?
No, we don't have no kind of resources or support. It's just all up to the individuals.
You don't think there's any way to bring them to the table like they did in Maine and speak to them that South Dakota is a completely different state?
South Dakota is going to have to be forced to the table. That's how bad it is. We're going to call for a congressional hearing.
Is that who's calling for that hearing?
We women, us women that are going there. As a nation.
Sandy
Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is backing us, and they'll be there also because the little girl that got hurt, she was from Standing Rock.
Oh, okay. So what do you think the reason that they're taking so many children away? Is it above just the money? Is it the simulation?
It's about only about the money. That's all the whole state of South Dakota is about, is money.
So are they trying to continue to eliminate you like they did with the residential schools and all the different forms of genocide? Is this part of that whole battle?
Yes, it is. Another tactic of genocide towards us. Yep.
And
you got to remember that greed has no humanity at all.
Exactly. Esther, are you still there?
I think so.
Yeah, I saw you drop off for a second.
I got disconnected and I called back in, so I think
that
I'm still
happens
on.
Sometimes. I'm glad you called back in.
Okay.
So, why do you think your state is so willing to come to the table where other states, it's a battle to get them to the table?
Well, like I mentioned before, we're a small state. There are, of all the Wabanaki tribes in the state, there's only 8,000 Wabanaki people left. I mean, the Wabanaki Confederacy, we originally had over 20 tribes, and over 16 of us have been totally decimated. I was actually speaking to a friend of mine, a Lakota friend, who had said, you know, he gave us a lot of, he said, I want to thank your people on the Eastern Seaboard, the Wabanakis and the Algonquins. He said, you really kept the colonizers at bay and away from some of our tribes here for, you know, a good couple hundred years. And those losses that we suffered are very great. I mean, I know that 8,000 Native people is, you know, there are 30,000 Natives in some of these cities, and there's only 8,000 of us left here. So, you know, I think that has something to do with it, having such a small state and being
right.
So connected to each other. And I also think that the Claim Settlement Act that was passed here in 1980, I don't know if folks are familiar with that, but it was a land claim settlement that the Passamaquoddies and the Penobscots settled with the federal government. At one time, that a treaty was found that gave us title to over two-thirds of the state of Maine in the late 70s. And as you can imagine, real estate stopped, and people were white folks in Maine were freaking out. And so through a lot of negotiations and we ended up settling for $80 million. And now our land claim settlement has kind of become the model of how not to do it, because in that settlement, we also, the Maine Implementing Act passed, which really limits our latitude and limits what we can do and limits our sovereignty. We really, like the Native Gaming Rights Protection Act doesn't apply to us. So we can't have casinos and gaming and things like that. So I think that we've had, in Maine, we've had a long, painful history, like all of our tribal communities around the country. But I really think that the numbers, the smallness of our state really has probably been the biggest factor. Like I said, some of the folks around that table, we went to school together. You know, we grew up in the same towns.
Right.
You know, I was listening to the conversation that you all were just having, and I, at one point years ago, I had served on this national board that Casey Family Services had. It was called the CARE Alliance, and they did a lot of research around Black, Latino, and Native children in foster care. And what they found out was everything being equal, the only thing that seemed to be the difference with these cases is race, that, you know, the disproportionate numbers of children of color in the child welfare system didn't have anything to do with anything except race and the color of their skin. So it's, you know, I know money is a big factor, but it's also racism. and it's also oppression. And like you were talking about, you know, continuing these policies of genocide, because we're not supposed to be here. From the time that the white folks came to this country, the policy was genocide, and that is it's in contrast to the policy against even African Americans. The policy
right.
against African Americans was one of racism. The white people needed to exploit their labor to get our land, but they needed us out of the way. Eradication was the policy, and it started with physical genocide, war, disease, and then when that didn't work, it moved to cultural genocide and taking our children. The boarding school movement of the late 1800s is a perfect example of that. You know, we know about the Canadian residential school system, and they have a Truth and Reconciliation commission for that. But what a lot of folks don't know is that system was built upon Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
That was the model school for how to kill the Indian and save the child. And we've, you know, we're talking hundreds and hundreds of years of policies and strategies meant to terminate us. And what I see is we need to undo that. We need to decolonize and undo all of that. And it's really hard work because none of us escape the responsibility to do that. White people have a responsibility to know
exactly.
how they benefit. And actually all non-Native people have a responsibility to know how they benefit from the fact that we're not supposed to be here. But Native people, we have a responsibility to see how we've taken that oppression that's been pushed on us, and we acted out on each other. And, you know, that lateral oppression, that lateral violence, internalized oppression. And it's very, very, I think that, to me, you know, that is our biggest challenge, is how to fight internalized oppression, because we do a really good job of hurting each other all the time. And it's evident, you know, like Misty, I think it was Misty mentioned the tribal councils, you know, not being there, not being able to fight. Well, we've been socialized and indoctrinated for hundreds of years to take care of white people. And just to try to undo that dynamic is very difficult and it's very hard, but it can be done. You know, it takes a fight on all fronts. It takes to fight the system of racism and the system of oppression and these institutions of racism, but institutions are made up of people. And so we also need to do that work by decolonizing our hearts and our minds. And that means, you know, having that love for people, loving the people who are loving the enemy, really, which is
exactly.
hard. It's very difficult.
And the other thing on my side, which I'm white, is that we were given very specific messages that were complete lies so that they could continue their behavior. So I think sometimes people believe, because sometimes it can be so annoying to be around us because we're so ignorant of what's happening to you. But we're just a piece of their tool to allow them to continue. They have a very specific lie that they're telling us. They're not just saying, guess what, we're going to wipe these people out. It's a very sneaky way that they're doing it, and they're making it seem like you're the reason why that a problem
mm-hmm.
is. And the way that they're indoctrinating us into that belief system allows us to be blind when they come and try to harm you. We're like, well,
yeah,
they're bringing it on theirself with no knowledge of the real history.
Unfortunately, the dynamic that usually happens is white folks will be confronted with this, the truth and this history, and you know the fact that they benefit from our intended destruction,
exactly.
and it's so hard to handle. They don't want it. Nobody wants
no.
this. I mean, they don't. This is a legacy we've all inherited that nobody wants. And a lot of times, what happens is it's so painful and it's so difficult. They move directly to, okay, how can I become Indian? Teach me your dances, teach me your songs, teach me your ceremonies.
Yeah.
Just continues the oppression of our people
yeah.
by co-opting our spirituality, and that is not the answer.
No, it's not the answer at all.
It's so difficult. I mean, white people have so many guilt, so much guilt about, and
right.
once they find out what their ancestors have done, they got a lot of guilt, and they're ashamed of themselves.
Well, you
and
know,
they don't want to be
I
who
wish
they
did have as much guilt as people think they do. But I don't see as much guilt because of the way that we've been told the story, we believe it's something that y'all are creating on yourself, and we, not me, I don't believe that, but that's what they're telling us, is that we're doing all we can to help these people, and they won't pull themselves up by their own bootstraps.
If you look at the whole social service and child welfare system in this country, I mean, we oppress poor white people. People are oppressed all over the place. Gay people are oppressed. I mean, oppression is everywhere. And the whole social services and child welfare system itself is based on the fact that some people are deserving and some people are undeserving. And that, you know, that's why we want to drug test people who get welfare, but we don't drug test CEOs of companies, who are receiving corporate welfare. So
it can change millions
structural...
of people's life within the stroke of a pen, and yet we care about this welfare mother and what she does with her check.
There's a lot of structural problems in this country that I think now, I mean, people talk about the prophecies of 2012. I think part of that is people are waking up. I mean, look at the Idol No More.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good time to finally wake up and start to do something. And I just totally applaud these women, Misty and Madonna, for just saying, just taking it, just going with it, and finally doing something. I just like totally honor you for doing that. It takes so much courage.
Mm-hmm. I've been trying to learn this about this subject now for about 5 years. It's one of the most complex things I've ever even tried to dissect. And the deeper you get in, it is a rabbit hole that there is no good way to undo what's been done. And it's extremely messy and layered and very hard for the average person to understand if they're willing to put in time, but which most people aren't, because they just want to go and live their life.
Mm-hmm.
But there's children that are dying because of our indifference. And that's why we have to turn and say, what is going on? And I'm tired of this being done in my name. And, I want my people to be the one that stand up going like, no more genocide in my name. I'm tired of it.
Because white people are the ones with the power. White people have the power in this country to make those changes, and they don't need to do it by getting an Indian name and becoming, a shaman. They need to do it by embracing who they are and being proud of being white and using that power to help everyone. And there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with being white,
And here a lot of people like that say, well, you're walking the red road, and no disrespect to the red road, but I don't want to. I'm walking the white road, but I'm walking it with humanity. And I want people to understand that white people have a lot of humanity if they understand what's going on. We got to get this media who's turning us all against each other out of our heads and recapture the message so that all of us are sitting here having a conversation about real things instead of all this other crap that happens every time you try to have a conversation with the different races.
Mm-hmm.
Here
in the state of South Dakota, all the whites are prejudiced. It doesn't matter. They're even prejudiced against their own people. And it's crazy because they use our kids. Like, I know the ICWA is supposed to be here to protect their children, but it hasn't been. Ever since they put it into effect in 1987, how many kids have been getting taken out of the home? How many kids got killed by a foster parent? How many mothers and fathers got their rights terminated? If we went back and looked into their records, it would probably be a whole room full of them, full of records of all the people they took, all the kids, all the parents.
Right.
I mean, they don't even know. They don't even go by their own laws.
Right.
And here's these two white people standing up for the kids, standing up for the natives, saying this is wrong, and they're going to condemn them. They're going to punish them for telling the truth.
And that's what we call the other world, like when you're white and you stand up, you are mm-hmm. there's an in-between world where you get to stay in the white world and live that little bubble world if you agree to turn your back on a lot of things that are happening. But when you start going, well, what's that over there? Why is this? Why is that? Then you're slowly pushed out of that bubble into that in-between world, which in itself can be very complicated because of all the history between, you know, natives and whites. That in-between world isn't the nicest place to be either.
Mm-mm. It's probably about the same world as we're in when it comes to them.
Yeah, and it's all, except less people because, you know, it takes a while sometimes for me to find another white person that's thinking the same way I am. So it's a little more isolating, but that's okay. There's amazing people I've met also for the work that I'm doing. So it balances out, you know, on one side
or
the other.
And not all whites are racist, you know, not all of them. I got a lot of good white friends, and I love them like they're my own family.
Right.
But it's the ones that are so ignorant and small-minded where their world just revolves in this little box that they got in their head, and that's it. Nothing else is going to come in or go out. Those ones that are the ones that are standing up against Indians, like when they say, get off our land, it's like, what? We're letting you live here. Our land? Where did that come from?
Yeah, we are pretty arrogant in the things that we say, like, you know, get off our land. That's crazy. But
I always remind them, I'm like, remember where your ancestors came from. They weren't born and raised here. They might have been born here, but your ancestors before that came across either a ship or a boat.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, Esther, can you tell us what the standard is for this law so that people can understand exactly what the law is or the act?
I'm confused. The Truth and Reconciliation process?
No, the Indian Child Welfare Act, what exactly is that?
Well, ICWA was a federal law that was passed in 1978, and it essentially makes legal higher standards of protection for Native children that are involved in state child welfare cases. Congress recognized that the integrity of Native culture and Native people lied in their children, and that there's a different special circumstances for Native children. There's another law called the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act, which
mm-hmm.
says you can't race can't be a factor in determining placement, and the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act does not apply to Indian child welfare cases because Congress recognized that special relationship, that the continued existence of our tribes and our communities and our culture depends on our children being able to be brought up and raised in our culture. So it makes legal different sets of standards. It also sets forth, it's not said in ICWA, but one way that ICWA is interpreted is that an ICWA case, the child has three parents. They have a mother, they have a father, and the tribe, because it recognizes that essential birthright that the tribe has to that child and the child has to that tribe.
Right.
So that's why there's one of the tenets of the law is notification of the tribe to the tribe when a child comes into state care. There's also a provision in placement preferences within ICWA. So when Native child in care and it's an ICWA case, and ICWA applies that a Native Indian child is defined as a member of a federally recognized tribe or a child who's eligible for membership. And so when that child is in care, the placement preferences are laid out as such that the first preference is for that child to be placed within their tribe. And the second preference is for the child to be placed with the first is with extended family. And ICWA does not
say it has to be the Native extended family. It could be the non-Native extended family, but the idea was that a non-Native relative would still be invested in keeping that child connected to their culture. It's not perfect. It doesn't always work that way. I have a nephew who was placed with his white grandmother, and then she, you know, moved out of state, and we haven't seen him since.
Right.
Because it doesn't always work that way. But, you know, the spirit of ICWA was intended to preserve the cultural integrity of Indian children. So after extended family, the next preference is to be placed within the child's tribe. And then after that, it's in the with a family in another tribe. And then the last preference is regular foster care. In the state of Maine, we actually, in 1999, the state legislature passed a law saying that, because prior to 1999, if there was an ICWA case, they could only place that child in a state-licensed foster home. And I'll tell you, there aren't enough state-licensed foster homes, and there are hardly any state-licensed Native foster homes.
Right.
So we worked with the tribes worked with the state, and legislature passed a law allowing the state to accept a tribally approved foster home and then give them that foster care reimbursement. So if a kid comes into, say, a Penobscot child comes into state care and there's no state-licensed Penobscot families, they call the Penobscot tribe up and they say, you know, do you have any foster homes for this child? And the tribe will say, yeah, we have this family. And, the tribe knows who we know all of our families and everybody knows everyone and the family history. So whatever their process is for approving that foster home, the state is not privy to that process. They just accept and they're able to give that family that foster care reimbursement. Because one of the big issues when a case comes in, there's an ICWA case, the tribe is given the option of transferring jurisdiction to tribal court, and many times the tribe wants to accept jurisdiction, but they can't because they don't have the financial resources to pay foster care reimbursement. And then sometimes they don't have, the family isn't in proximity to be able to be, if you have a Penobscot family living down in southern Maine, 2 hours away from the reservation, it's not in the child's best interest to take them and bring them to the reservation when their family is in, their mother's in Portland and they need to be reunified with their mom, and so they should be close to her. So there's a lot of considerations, but that law in 1999, which allowed the state to pay foster care to a tribally approved foster home, has really made a big impact on our Native children being able to stay with Native families.
All right, let me down just a second and ask you about this. So a child is placed in a Native foster care approved place. Who pays for that money? Is that the tribe that pays for it, or is that the state that pays for it?
No, in an ICWA case, see, ICWA is only applies to Native children who are in state care.
Okay.
When it comes down to it, tribes really don't have to follow ICWA, because ICWA only applies to state Native children in state care. So if a Native child comes into state care, the state in the past used to have to place that child in a state-licensed foster home. But now they can place that child in a tribally licensed foster home, a foster home that the tribe approves of. And that has had Native children stay within their extended family.
And
it has allowed
that.
Them... Yes, and the state pays that foster care reimbursement. Tribes receive money to administer child welfare programs from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and a lot of times it's not enough money. And a lot of times they don't have money when children are special needs and are in need of a therapeutic foster home. Oftentimes tribes don't have that kind of money. So sometimes they won't ask for a transfer of jurisdiction to tribal court, because there's no funding to support that, and it's not in the best interest of the child. But this helps that. This has helped, and this whole idea of kinship care that has taken a hold in child welfare practice around the country, that's traditional. That's how we have always raised our children. You know, the grandmas and aunties and uncles raising children has been something that we've always done. And so the mainstream child welfare system has learned from Native people, and they're calling it kinship care.
And see, whenever the state gets a Native kid in and they're supposed to go by the ICWA law, But once they get that kid, and they're supposed to get a hold of the tribe to get let them know where their kids are, but they don't do that. Once they get a kid, they right away, their brains go to money, money, money. So then they get a hold of the government. That's the first person they get a hold of. And they say, well, we got some Native kids in here, and they need treatment, they need counseling. So then that's when the kid becomes in child in need. And then, so then the state gets all this money, and then they don't even contact the tribes. They could say that all they want, but they don't. Because I know a lot of kids that are in foster care to this day where the state doesn't even try to contact them. I'm trying to get my cousin's kids back where her rights were violated, and they terminated her parental rights. They never contacted our tribe, and if they did, then we got a program down here called OnTrack. I have no faith in them at all. I've never seen them get back kids and say, here, and then try to work with them. Instead, they just get them, and then they say, well, here's the parents, here's your kids, and give them back. Where are they helping the kids? Why aren't they getting involved and saying, well, we need to get them in counseling. You can't just give a mom her kids back. She got them taken away when she was drinking, and then say, oh, here's your kid. We got them back for you. Go on, move on. Where is OnTrack's job getting involved and helping that mother keep her kids? But they don't do that. Mm-hmm. And on state thing, I just, whenever they talk about them saying they go by the ICWA, they don't go by the ICWA. They like to lie. They're the biggest bullshit is in the world.
Because ICWA also states that once jeopardy is removed, because a child needs to, you know, there's a legal standard of jeopardy that needs to be met before a child can be removed from a home. And ICWA states that all child welfare losses, there has to be jeopardy. And within ICWA, it states once jeopardy has been removed, the child needs to be returned. So that's another point at which it seems like there's not compliance with the Indian Child Welfare Law from what you're saying. And, you know, there has to be, you know, the things that are going through my head are education of judges, education of attorneys that work for the state, education of guardians ad litem. They need to be educated on ICWA, and there has to be some kind of consequences, or, you know, Administration for Children and Families, who gives every state money to administer their child welfare programs, somehow, you know, I don't know if this is happening, but somehow they need to be aware that such gross violations of ICWA are happening in your state.
Yeah. I know it's all messed up, our whole court system in the whole United States when it comes to our Native kids. They're not really there to help them. They're not there to make sure they're in a safe environment. When they get the kids, all they see is money. I mean, everybody don't like it that we talk like that, but you know what? Our kids are the biggest money makers in the United States. They make so much money off of them that, it really irritates me.
Yeah, another
factor. When it comes to talking about them, I'm like,
When they are released from care and they end up heading to prison, then that's just a second way that they make money off the children. They create the circumstances. And then when the children have all kind of issues because of the foster care system, then now they go into the prison system and begin getting paid again.
That's another form of genocide, the prison system. The more people they take away their rights, the less Natives have any rights to say anything about the kids, the land, anything. So that's their other form of genocide, is putting them in prison, taking away their rights as people.
Right, and taking away the people from the community itself so that they can't produce more children over time. And it goes back down to... you know, your right to be federally recognized is always a target, from what I've seen, too, that you have to have certain... Go ahead.
Has the National Indian Child Welfare Act, National Indian Child Welfare Association, been of any help, or have they been contacted? Are they a resource to help with these issues that are happening in your state,
in South Dakota?
Yeah.
Well, mostly, like, our people down here are intimidated. There's a lot of us that are assimilated, oppressed, and so when it comes to talking to white people, they put the tail between their leg and they put their head down, and they let them talk down to them like that. And
mm-hmm.
so, we have sources that are supposed to be helping us protect our kids, but even them guys get intimidated when it comes to court time and they go into court. Like in Sioux Falls, they're really no good in Sioux Falls. They do not recognize ICWA at all. They ain't ashamed to not say it. They put it on their paperwork. It's just it's a big mess here in South Dakota.
Similar to what happened in Canada. I mean, the truth and reconciliation process in Canada around the boarding schools only happened because of massive class action lawsuits.
Yes.
That the tribes were engaging in against the country of Canada. If it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't for that threat of lawsuits and losing money, that TRC would never have happened. And it sounds like
mm-hmm.
something really massive and drastic needs to happen in South Dakota for things to start changing. You know, I know that there's this mentality that ICWA doesn't apply, or, you know, I remember a judge in a Massachusetts court in Cambridge saying, you know, this is Cambridge, that ICWA doesn't apply
mm-hmm.
here. You know, it's a federal law. It applies to
mm-hmm.
every state in the union.
Mm-hmm.
And it's,
right.
you know, that arrogance that's so disheartening and so hard to, it's so hard to fight. But, you know, the more you get it out there and the more you talk about it, you know, I remember that show that I never watched it, that Dr. Phil show, but I heard a lot about it.
Yeah, I watched it.
It was so disgusting to think
it was
that those things were being said.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it was more disgusting because he's supposed to know better. He's all in the legal system, and he had no clue. So if him, with all his exposure, had such a white concept of the law itself, then that worries me, that how do we get the truth out to the regular people of what's going on? Because that show did a lot of damage, in my opinion. So and he just didn't get it. He just didn't understand the genocide. And that's what happens. The white community looks at the genocide like it happened in the 1800s, and what does that have to do with us? They have no clue that it's right there at your doorstep every single day. You
mm-hmm.
you wake up and there's one form or another where they're coming to take away your rights or resources, or
mm-hmm.
it's a battle just to be able to exist every single day. And that's
yep.
what the white society doesn't understand, because all they think is, we're giving them all this money, why won't they do something to help themselves?
Exactly. Yep, when it comes to the money, that's the whole thing about it. And that's why, like, I don't like it when our tribe says we're a sovereign nation. We're not a sovereign nation because they still get federal funding. Until the day that they start making their own money come in, we got so much young potential grant writers that we could just make our own cash flow instead of getting money off of them for this and that. And they always use the kids' name and bring in the kids, but when it comes down to it, where are all the programs that are supposed to be here helping our children?
But
we cannot say we're a sovereign nation until the day we stop saying no more federal money. We don't need your money.
But
another perspective on that, Misty, is that the federal money that we do get, I think if we stop looking at it like a handout, it's not a handout. It's a drop in the bucket of what is owed to us for what we have paid and how we have paid. In a 97% population depletion since first contact.
Mm-hmm.
there's only 3% of original population left of Native people. And all of that money we get through the BIA to run our programs is not, it's not a gift. It's not charity. It's not a handout. It's what we are due. And it's only a fraction of what we are due compared to what we have suffered and what we have lost. So I believe we can be sovereign nations and that the federal government owes that to us.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's been a lot of treaties and everything
else. We could say they owe us all we want, but in their eyes, they don't owe us nothing. And that's why they're raking at our kids. They can't get at us through any other way, but they could get at us through our kids. And I'm a grandma, and I'll be damned if I'm going to let anybody try to take my grandkids away from my kids, because I'll fight for them. I'll die for those little guys. I love all my grandchildren, all my tacos. As they just all have a special heart in my heart, a special place, and I'm going to fight for them. I'm going to fight for all the little kids out there that don't have anybody to take up for them. This is one grandma that's going to be there.
Ladies, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back, and we'll talk some more, okay?
Okay. Can I call you back?
Sure, if you need to, that's fine.
All right, I'll call back in about 5 minutes.
All righty. Talk to you then.
Okay.
All right,
bye.
To our elders who teach us of our creation and our past, so we may preserve Mother Earth for ancestors yet to come, we are the land. This is dedicated to our relatives before us, thousands of years ago, and to the 150 million who were exterminated across the Western Hemisphere in the first 400 years' time, starting in 1492. To those who have kept their homeland, and to the nations extinct due to mass slaughter, slavery, deportation, and disease unknown to them, and to the ones who are subjected to the same treatment today, to the ones who survived the relocation and the ones who died along the way, to those who carried on traditions and lived strong among their people, to those who left their communities by force or by choice and for generations no longer know who they are, to those who search and never find, to those that turn away the so-called non-accepted, to those that bring us together, and to those living outside, keep in touch, the voice for many. To those that make it back to live and fight the struggles of their people, to those that give up and those who do not care, to those who abuse themselves and others, and those who revive again, to those who are physically, mentally, or spiritually incapable by accident or by birth, to those who seek strength in our spirituality and ways of life, and those who exploit it, even our own. To those who fall for the lies and join the dividing lines that keep us fighting amongst each other. To the outsiders who step in, good or bad, and those of us who don't know better. To the leaders and prisoners of war, politics, crime, race, and religion, innocent or guilty. To the young, the old, the living, and the dead, to our brothers and sisters and all living things across Mother Earth, and her beauty we've destroyed and denied the honor that the Creator has given each individual, the truth that lies in our hearts, all my relations.
everyone. Esther, are you there? Esther?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. One thing I wanted to ask you, because my biggest struggle in putting this kind of information out is the ability to communicate on both sides. I want to know, when you came to the table and you're sitting across from everyone, what were some surprises that you found on the communication on both sides?
Surprises?
Or difficulties, or what is it that you observed trying to have these conversations?
Well, I think... Let me think about that. It was real difficult because the state was on the defensive, of course, and they knew why we were there. They had asked us to be there, so they were a little bit humbled, but they were also a bit defensive. I think in looking back through all of the work that we've done, I can tell you when we had the times and the things that we did to turn a corner and to really make some progress. And it really wasn't until we got together and we did this exercise where we got into groups of three. And we each had 2 minutes to talk, and then the other two folks would have to listen in this little group of three. And we had 2 minutes to talk about and share something about ourselves that we wanted the other people to know. So we really, it wasn't until we started relating to each other and tapping into our humanity and really having a love for each other that we were able to break through some of this, the hurt that's been piled on all of us through oppression, whether it's internalized oppression or white people that have, you know, that they're part of the system. All white people have racism. It's nothing that they've chosen. It's what they've been born into. All Indian people have internalized oppression. It's nothing that we chose. It's how it is. So just, it wasn't until we started relating to each other that way.
Seeing each other as people.
We'd sit across the table from each other with our arms crossed, and we had, you know, we're climbing that ladder of inference. Oh, she said this, it must be because of this and that and that and that. You know, and it wasn't until we stopped doing that and we put our defenses down and we really related to each other as people that we were able to really break through and do this work. What I came to realize is that the Native folks around the table, you know, we were there not only because we wanted to go be social workers and do child welfare. We were there because this is the survival and the mere existence of our people depended on us doing this work. The white people at the table, you know, a lot of times they had to reconcile who they were as real individuals, who they were as people, and who they wanted to be with the job that they had to do. So on some level, they had another layer to work through. You know, and I think through this work, we have been able, you know, on that individual level, to see each other as human beings, as people who are completely good and completely loving. I'm saying it sounds Pollyanna, but it's freaking hard.
I completely understand how hard, because the first thing I have to do when I'm speaking with different natives, not all of them, just some of them, is they have to go through first, what kind of white person am I? So it actually is a process of them eliminating their perception of who I am before they actually get to the point where, oh, she's not here to screw us over, or she's not going to have that hidden arrogance, or she's, you know, all those different things. And that takes a while. It takes a while. And some communities are more isolated than others. So some people say if you live more in the mainstream as opposed to reservation, where you interact more with white people, then it may be a quicker process. But it's a difficult process either way, and from what I've experienced.
I mean, sometimes, you know, for my own self, I've had to just picture them as being newborns. Picture them as, you know,
how they came into the world and what the Creator really wants them to be, what the Creator has meant for them to be, and to try to understand that everything else is stuff that's been piled on top of them, and it's been hurts that they've experienced, that we all have experienced, and they all manifest themselves in different ways. And to also, you know, it's really hard for white people to come to terms with the fact that everything that they enjoy from the land that they walk on, everything comes at the price of somebody else's fate and somebody else's genocide and destruction. Exactly.
And the other aspect is you have to undo everything that you believe in, because you believe we've been told America is bringing freedom, and now we're sitting across the table with people who are saying, you're killing us. You're killing us at every turn, and you've been doing it for 500 years, and we've been sold all this. We're bringing freedom, and we're the good guys. And in y'all's eyes, y'all have a completely different version of history than we do. And it's very hard for those two to meet.
That's because they put the white man's history on books, but they never put the history of the natives.
Exactly.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so now we have to unlearn all the history that we learned in order to begin to see the true history. And then what do we do with that history once we see it? What do
we
do with the fact that...
In my experience, Native people don't know our own history either. I mean, we put together a real good historical PowerPoint that talks about Wabanaki people in the state and talks about genocide and forced assimilation. And we were taught, you know, by and large, we were taught the same history too. You know, some of our oral histories have survived, but a lot of them haven't. Our languages have been subjugated. You know, we have a very low fluency rate in our communities. You know, and then again, you know, you think about how long we've had contact here compared to some of the tribes in the West.
Right.
So there's that difference there too. But it's a shared history. It's the history of our people in this state is not only Wabanaki history. It belongs to Maine citizens too. It's their history. It's part of their legacy. You know, for them to realize that this property they own on the coast of Maine was doled out to their ancestors based on how many Native people they killed. You know, that there was a bounty placed on Penobscot heads and scalps and bodies that gave different prices for ages and different genders of Penobscot people. You know, that's horrific. And when, you know, even Native people don't even know that here in our state. So we're really doing, we're doing a lot of education.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a dramatically different history for sure. And you're right, a lot of Natives don't, because they've been put in these systems and removed from their people as well, so they don't understand their own history. But when you say have contact, can you just define that a little bit for the people who may not understand what you're speaking about?
Contact with Europeans?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had contact here in our state from the 1500s on. And I know that some tribes out west have been able to, they've only had contact less than that, maybe the 1700s, by the time the westward expansion happened and white people got to that part of the country, you know, before the Spaniards came up from the south and the French and the English came over from the east. So we were on the front lines. You know, we were the first Native people to be exterminated here on this side.
So it's important for people to understand, too, that each nation has their own historical trauma that they're coming out of, because as it spread across, each one had their own experience. So you have to see what experience the people living within your community have as well. Right, Misty?
Yep. Exactly.
So, Misty, within your community, what do you want to happen? What do you want people to do?
I wanted people to grow balls and start standing up for what's right. That's what I want in our community. We need more backbones and less wishbones.
Yeah. I like that. That's a good one.
And I would like it for them to start standing up and realizing that, I mean, our children are our future. If there's no children, there's no future for us.
Right.
And so what we need to do is our tribal councils need to get more involved when it comes to the kids. Our people need to start standing up and get more involved when it comes to the kids, because it might not be their kids now, but
right.
it could be their kids later on. And so I just think that, and the mothers need to realize that the Creator gave us these children. They don't belong to us. They're His kids. He can take them home anytime He wants. And, you know, when we brought them into the world, they came into the world with nothing, not knowing nothing. It's our job to teach them as they grow. And it's sad that alcohol really took over our people out here in the Midwest. And it's sad that a lot of our parents forgot where their role is and who they're supposed to be, and that they got this little being that's here that they have to nourish just like a flower and water it and make sure it grows and becomes beautiful. But it's sad because alcohol, and now it's pills. Pills are taking over the people. The ones that ain't doing the alcohol are doing the pills, but they're just as messed up in the mind as the people that are doing the alcohol thing. And so I would like for our people to finally wake up. I'm not going to say we were idle, because we were never idle. The Oglalas were never idle. We were always aware of what was going on. We were always fighting against our oppressors. And I just pray for the kids all the time. I pray for the people that Tungashla helps them be strong and helps them remember where our nation came from and who they came from. On my side, on my dad, it's Crazy Horse. So when people ask me where I come from, I say, I came from Crazy Horse on my dad's side and Sitting Bull on my mom's side. That's where I came from. And I remind my kids, and my kids are going to be activists when they get older too because of me, and just like I am because of my parents, who my parents were, that we ain't going to back down. We're going to be here, and we're always going to be here.
And what would you say to the white family who is raising your child, your children from your community right now? What would you say to them?
I'm going to say we're going to get them back, and they're going to remember where they're at, where they're from, where they come from. Because even though they're stuck out there somewhere in the world, eventually their ties are going to bring them back home. It's in their heart. It's in their blood. And we will get our kids back.
Is there anything that foster parent or adopt a parent can do until that point to help them not lose their culture?
Tell them who they're from. Tell them where they come from. Tell them who their tribe is. You know, don't make them think that they belong to you and that they came from you, because they didn't. They have a mother and they have a father out there, and they have grandparents who love them. And it's not the parents' fault. The system is failing them and taking their kids and taking their parental rights. It's sad that a lot of them didn't have backbones and stand up and say, no, you're not taking my kids, instead of bowing down and saying, okay, because we have these white people saying, you're no good, you can't afford it, you could do better, you don't have to worry about money. But It's a lot more than the money situation when it comes to a parent, you know. It doesn't matter how poor you are or how sad you live.
when there's love for a child, it doesn't matter. None of that stuff matters as long as your baby's all right and you're taking care of them. That's all that matters.
And to somebody who is trying to find their way home, what would you say to them?
I would say, come home. Come home and get to know your family. Get to know where your genes are, where they come from, your lineage. Come home. There's always somebody here with open arms that can.
Is there anything else you would like to say before I go to Esther and then wrap up?
Yep, I'm going to let the white guys know out there, the state of South Dakota, that we're here and we're listening and we ain't giving up. And they want to fight, they're going to have a fight.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Esther, is there anything that you would like to say before we wrap up?
Just that this work is really difficult and it's, decolonization is really hard and it's very painful. And it takes a lot of courage and a lot of tears. And that, you know, that what we're doing here with our TRC is essentially we're opening this big can of worms. We're getting people to talk about what happened to them. And we had a lot of fears around that. We thought, geez, if people start sharing and revisiting what happened, they're going to start drinking and drugging and committing suicide. But we're already doing that because silence is not working for us. So keeping it in. And not speaking about it is killing us. So we are taking the risk, a very calculated risk, and we're very cognizant of supporting people through this truth-telling period where they'll be talking to the commission and telling them what happened, and we'll be there to support them, and we're developing a cushion for them to help catch them when they fall because we really believe, you know, that it's going to get worse before it will get better, but we have to rip that, you know, we have to take that Band-Aid off and we have to dig that pus out of this wound before it can heal up properly.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I applaud your work and your willingness to come to the table and have the hard conversations because it is as hard as it gets, especially when you're talking about something as sensitive as your children. And I wish you ladies both well, and Fire Talk is here to support you in any struggles that you encounter. Just get in touch with me, and I'll give you air time to get your message out.
Thank you, Mel.
Thank you.
All right. You have a wonderful day. We're going to end the show with Going Back by Floyd Red Crow Westerman. It doesn't get any better than that. All right.
Take care, women.
Take care. Keep
fighting. Bye-bye.
Going back to the land I love. Going back to where the truth began. Back to the land I left behind. Back to the pride that I must find. Leave me alone. Can't you see I'm going home? Going back. In there I'm gonna stay. Going back to try and find the way. Back to the land I left behind. Back to the pride that I must find. Leave me alone. Can't you see I'm going wrong? Back to the mountain and the prairie. Back to the desert and the hills. catch up to the buffalo, and where the rivers flow. Going back, and there I'm gonna stay. Going back to try and find a way back to the land I left behind, back to the pipe that I most find. Leave me alone, can't you see I'm going? Can't you see I'm going home?